Accession number 33250, reel 11.
Okay. So John Wilton, reel 11.
We were billeted in what was a former Hitler Youth summer holiday resort. It was a castle where the deserving young Nazis would be sent to have a nice time in Austria. In the yard there was an open a Mercedes open touring car, which my driver and fitter quickly wired up to see if it would start, and it would. We then looked around the place and met the commandant of the place, the chap who was in charge of this Hitler Youth establishment. Well, he was, of course, a category of people whom we were instructed to take into custody and pass on to security people for interrogation. So we explained to him that he would have to accompany me to Wolfsburg and so on, and with a rather frosty grace he did so. And when he saw the my driver wire up his car and started off, we went off to Wolfsburg and I handed him over. And as we left, he said, "Der Schlüssel unserer Wagen," the key of our car. So from that time on, I had a Mercedes for a while. But anyway, there was there we were in this place, very well equipped, lots of skis and things like that. Not that that was much use to us in the month of May, but anyway, we were looking around, where is the Burgomaster and so on. And down the road came a French sergeant major. Saluted smartly and reported so. And he was in charge of a group of French prisoners of war who were working on the farms there, been put onto agricultural duties, he said incidentally, they have a very large store of food in a building along here, and this and that and so on. And then he said, incidentally, my chaps haven't had any meat to eat for some weeks now, and I wonder if I might be permitted to purchase a cow for them. So I said, well, why not? As far as I'm concerned, purchase your cow. So the next morning I saw a rather disgruntled chap leading a cow along on the end of a rope and the sergeant major in front of him. And I said, morning, sergeant major, I see you bought your cow. Good price, was it? It was the current market price. So I guess that the chap didn't get very much for his cow, but they were. It was very useful, you see, to be able to report on the food store, because all these things had to be clamped down. I mean, you couldn't allow the populace just to get into the food store and themselves. And that aspect of life in Austria, it was patchy, of course, but wherever you could, you got hold of the burgomaster and put him on the spot and said, that food is to be guarded, and we will tell you eventually what to do with it. But by this time we'd been moved back to almost where we came in, to Villach, which was where we were to be stationed. And we arrived back in Villach, and I was riding in the jeep with my driver and my batman and my baggage and so on. We'd sent the second in command along to reconnoitre the village and see where we would be, where was the best place to be billeted, and he decided to put the company into the school, and the officers would be in a couple of blocks of flats which were the property of the frontier police. But there weren't any frontier police about. There were a couple of there were three widows, or four widows, or three widows and a housekeeper, but anyway, there was no men about, and he had planted us one in each of the flats, and another flat for the officers' mess. That was fine. I said righto, and I got out, grabbed my kit, and with my batman Keaton, we moved into the place. I dumped my kit in the room and said, righto, you see to that. I will now go and see where the company are in the school next door. So off I went. And when I came back, I was coming in, and the lady who was living in the flat at the time said, "Wann kommt der Herr Major?" She'd been told, you see, that the major would be here and the captain would be there, and the officer. I said, I am the major. And she looked at me. Who's this chap who arrived in a jeep and unloaded his kit himself? And he can't. Must be pulling my leg, I suppose, she thought. But anyway, they slowly got used to the idea that just being a major didn't mean that everybody in sight sprang to attention. But what was even more impressive, you see, was that I had a military cross and a mention in dispatches. Well, the military cross is quite a nice silver job. It's polished up, it looks pretty good. And the mention in dispatches is an oak leaf which goes on the victory medal. So they looked at this cross, oak leaf, and the word went round the village, "Der Herr Major hat Ritterkreuz und Eichenlaub." He's got a knight's cross and oak leaves, which is like saying he's got a GCB or some, you know. I mean, he's got the sort of decoration which a general or somebody might have. Well, I didn't try to explain to them the intricacies, the details of British decorations. They slowly got used to the idea, to our peculiar ways. The Irish are very democratic people, and I was on quite familiar terms with my Behman and driver, for example. You know, they didn't click their heels every time I moved. Slowly, the locals got used to the idea. I think they quite liked us by the time, when I left 18 months later. They seemed quite sorry to see us go. See me go. I suppose they hoped that whoever came after me would be as easy as on them as I was. But
had you received your military cross for a particular action?
Sorry.
Had you received your military cross, military dispatches for a particular action?
It's always difficult to know that in wartime, unless it is some spectacular thing. I don't know. There were one or two occasions when I did something silly, you know, for any one of which I might have been. But in war, unless it's something spectacular, you never see a citation. At least you didn't, as the war on. At the beginning of the war, of course, every decoration was, the citation was known, and so on and so forth. But there were hundreds and so on. Earlier in the war, or nowadays in the sort of state that we're in now, if you get a military cross, you're liable to be invited to Buckingham Palace or somewhere to get it, or there's some sort of ceremony and so on. By the end of the war, that really had ceased to happen, and all that happened was that from time to time it would be posted in battalion orders that so-and-so or so-and-so had got a military cross. I don't know which of my many activities most attracted attention. Anything from facing down the Bulgars to doing some particularly nasty patrol. There was so much that it is really difficult to tell. But we left. I didn't tell you about the train. We were instructed that before the train moved on up to Wolfsburg, we were to disarm the chaps who were on it, they were to surrender. Well, the train was actually still in, was still further down the line a bit, and it was in B Company's area, and so it fell to Major Phelan to take the surrender of the troops on the train. And he was a South African with a very pronounced Afrikaner accent, and he addressed this lot in Afrikaner, which is near enough to German for them to get the drift of what he was saying, there they were, all drawn up, as they always would to the last. They looked like a lot of guardsmen on parade, you know, all absolutely stiff as ramrods and so on, determined that whatever they did, they would do while maintaining their dignity and so on. Major Phelan in Afrikaans just said, they were going to present arms, pile arms. He said, chuck them in the back of the trucks. They with very sour faces, they had to throw their weapons into the backs of the 3-ton trucks, and off they went. Way up the road, when we were moving between Wolfsburg and Villach in the earlier stages of our arrival, we saw another place where a battalion were marching down. Well, I say battalion, there was a body of troops marching down the road and being told to throw their rifles down the ravine into the river below. The other thing that sticks in my mind is that when we got to Wolfsburg, we saw beside the road one or two emaciated figures dressed in those striped pajamas, thin cotton pajamas. I mean, by this time it was May, and it was tolerably warm, but there they were, still. Well, I say still, this was within 48 hours of our arrival in Austria, and within a few days of the end of the war, but they were still in these damned rags and looking half-starved. I never found out what became of them, but I mean, the only other thing that I can tell you about concentration camps and so on is that the man who was appointed or elected, however the thing happens, the man who became the burgomaster in Lachach and district after we arrived there and settled in, had just been released from Dachau, and he was a very well-educated, cultivated, sensible sort of chap, but he was bitter, and when we were told in September, we moved in May, when we were told at the beginning of September that the schools had to be reopened and the children got back to school and we were to get out of the school and go and find somewhere else to live, I said to the burgomaster, where are we going to I have a place for you, he said. And he took us up to a block of flats, a lot of disconsolate people were coming out of the flats and going about, one of them stopped in front of the burgomaster and said, and where are we to go? And he said, it is mir ganz wurst. It's all sausage to me where you go. You can go where you bloody well like. But he reckoned that these flats were occupied by Nazis, he wasn't concerned to bother with them at all. You can go where you like. Oh. Thoughts that we might record. It's interesting to remember that in Sicily, at the time that we were attacking Tenturipe, the order was that we would strip down to minimum equipment, water bottle, gas mask, and gas cape, I mean, and necessary, I mean, as much ammunition and weapons as we could carry. That was it. You didn't even bother with an entrenching tool because you knew that you couldn't make any impression on the rocks with an entrenching tool. And from time to time, from then onwards, in Italy during the hot weather, the sort of standard fighting kit of the British soldier was minimal. It made, of course, for problems. If you were successful in your attack, the fact that you were lightly loaded and able to move and so forth was fine. But if you got stuck and you used up your ammunition and so forth, you were faced with a cold night and you'd got only you hadn't got anything warmer than a gas cape to put over your shirt sleeves, it could be difficult. But this is always one of the problems of the discrepancy between the attacking and the defending. Of course, the defending chap can be dug in, he can be well supplied, he can get his ammunition stacked up against the time when he needs it, whereas the chap who is attacking has got eventually to attack with whatever he can carry about his person. I think really does underline the importance of having a good supply chain. The theory, and generally speaking, the practice was that although you left your pack and any other kit that you could on the truck, on the quartermaster's 1500 weight truck, that was to come up as soon as was possible, and generally it did. And if you needed to dig in, it would have entrenching tools and a pick and shovel and so forth. But I suppose there were occasions when it didn't work, and we were fortunate that generally speaking it did work. And the only time when we were cut off and were not able where no supplies reached us was when we were snowed in Capricotta, until they dropped them by parachute, which which was very very gratifying to see a great hamper coming down. Good.
What sort of rations were you supplied with while you were on the front line?
There was a thing called a compo ration. A compo ration was a box of rations which would contain enough food for 14 men for a day. Tins of this and that. And there were several different compo packs, five, I think, different ones. One would have steak and kidney pudding, tinned steak and kidney pudding and stuff like that, tinned rice pudding, bacon, and so on. And others would have meat and veg and things. There were the sort of pack which was the favourite and the sort of pack which you hoped you wouldn't always get. Then there were cigarettes and so forth and biscuits and margarine and marmalade or jam or something. You know, they were all that was the way it was made up. Tins of sardines or some. But that was fine. You could live on that. From time to time, You got American rations, for example, casino for a while. We got American rations, and they were a great treat. You know, you said, by Jove, yes, you got American cigarettes, and you got more of them. I think we got 7 a day, and the Americans got 10 a day, or something like that. But anyway, but after a while, you found that the American biscuits, which were rather sweeter than ours, and the Spam, which we thought was absolutely tremendous. I mean, gosh, Spam. But after a while, Spam and American biscuits palled. And Bully Beeford and our rather plain biscuits was something you could go on with. It may not have had the immediate appeal of the Spam and biscuits, but you didn't go off it in the way in which eventually you went off the American ration. Even the Americans complained about the, you know, the fact that you got jolly soon fed up with Spam and their biscuits and stuff that they had in there. The answer is, of course, that it was a change, and it was a welcome change. But then, of course, as soon as you got out of the line, you went back onto more conventional supplies. The answer being, whatever a skillful organisation could collect up. Rations came from all over the place. A lot of our stuff came from India, from Australia, from, you know, there were there was a terrible period when the cigarettes that you got, I've forgotten what they were called now, but they were made in India or somewhere, and they were horrible. And you said, oh dear, I wish we were back on Compo, where at least you get the proper cigarettes. You know, you may only get 7, but they are they're players or something, you know. The whole business of rationing is extraordinarily difficult. As I say, the main impression left with me was the extraordinary efficiency with which it came up. If you read memoirs of the First World War and so on, it's astounding how frequently the rations didn't arrive, or, you know, and mind you, they were better placed living in France, in most of the area in France, apart from that which was totally destroyed in the fighting area. Life went on, and you could buy food and so forth. And of course, the same was true in Italy, that if you weren't actually fighting, there was a fair chance that you could buy food. I mean, that the quartermaster could buy food, not just that you could go into a restaurant and have a meal, but that it was possible to buy supplies of vegetables, meat, and so forth. Some things not. I don't think we ever had fresh milk. I don't think we ever had butter in the rations. We had tinned margarine, cottonseed oil margarine, it was called. There are obvious difficulties in wartime about living off the land in which you are fighting. Generally speaking, the populace also need to feed, and military operations disrupt their life too. So You don't want to feed at the expense of the population, but if you've got a good quartermaster, they can generally buy enough decent food to see you through. The brigadier used to say that as far as the Irish Brigade were concerned, he wished it to be understood that they didn't want any of these potato substitutes. They wanted potatoes, so if there are any potatoes going, we would like to have some. And similarly, when there was, as there often was, rather a shortage of whiskey, and it got a bit rationed, and he said, "We don't mind the Irish whiskey. You can send us any of the Irish whiskey," which tended to get set aside in favour of Scotch whiskey. It was generally easier in the Naffy to find a bottle of Irish whiskey than it was to find a bottle of Scotch whiskey if there was a shortage. We didn't do too badly on supplies.